Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Governor Newsom has two more weeks to sign or veto a stack of bills sitting on his desk after a marathon legislative session that went into overtime to get bills through to Newsom. Several still need to be decided on, some more controversial than others. One of them, now officially on the books, will allow county judges to order treatment for people suffering from addiction and severe mental illness. Another could up the minimum wage for fast food workers to $22. Meantime, as we head into election season, there is growing discussion over the lack of debate scheduled between candidates up and down the ballot. Lots to discuss about what's happening at the state capitol. We're joined by Cap Radio's politics reporter, Nicole Nixon, for the very latest. Good morning, Nicole.
Good morning.
Okay, so August 31st was the legislative deadline for lawmakers at the capitol to get their bills passed, sent to the Governor Newsom's desk. How many bills made it through, roughly?
I believe there were more than 900 bills on Newsom's desk when the session ended a couple weeks ago. That is of like 2,000 bills that were introduced this year. And of course, he signed some before, you know, August rolled around. And he has a month to sign or veto these bills into law, that deadline coming up September 31st.
Yeah, we're about a halfway through a month, you know, that the governor has, give or take, to sign or veto bills into law. Do we have a sense of how many he's actually taken action on?
Yeah, the total that I did a few days ago before another batch, I haven't had the time to add those in yet, but it was about three dozen, maybe four or five dozen.
Out of like 900?
So we should see some activity ramp up very quickly.
Reminds me in college, you know, when I'm preparing for a final or something. Okay, well, let's talk about some of the ones that he did sign into law yesterday, Care Court.
Yeah. So as we heard, you know, in the newscast and at the top of the show here, this would allow county judges to, well, it would require counties to set up systems and allow judges to order civil through the civil system. So it wouldn't be like enforceable by throwing people in jail if they don't comply, but to order treatment for people with addiction or severe mental illness. The governor has really been framing this as a new way of doing things. He's saying that existing things like conservatorships are not working. And, you know, you walk past and you drive past people living on the streets and you see them day after day. And many counties and cities feel their hands are tied. They really can't do much to help these people. So the governor is hoping that, you know, this will be a new way of doing things and a new solution. But, you know, as we've talked about on this show, a lot of pushback to this idea from civil rights groups and disability rights groups.
Yeah, and even some counties saying they don't have the resources as they stand to scale up and shoulder this additional responsibility.
Right. In the last few days of the session, there was, you know, there were some changes to this. I think some funding was promised to counties that, you know, for help setting up their own systems. But the issue that remains here is that this country and this state is already facing a massive shortage of workers in this behavioral health and mental health treatment spaces. And so being able to recruit all these new people to provide this treatment is a very big question mark. Mm.
Despite all the debate that was going on about Care Court, I mean, was yesterday pretty much a formality? We kind of knew that he obviously had the votes and that it's something that he wanted.
Right. Yes. It was a chance for him to get up, you know, in front of the cameras. This was his idea from the beginning and say, like, here we are. What was interesting to me is that this bill got through the legislature with a lot of support on both sides of the aisle, even though there were some Democrats that, you know, expressed skepticism, you know, repeating the concerns that civil rights groups have about its actual implementation. And so now the timeline is there are seven counties that have to roll it out as sort of like a pilot group within the next year. And the rest of California's 58 counties will be on the hook to, you know, roll out their own programs by 2025.
Mm. On the flip side, does it strike you that the governor vetoed safe injection sites, something that he indicated years before that he was open to?
Yeah, and we can talk about this a little bit later, but you know, there's this issue or this idea, conversations that the governor might be seeking a presidential run eventually, and how this played into that. Yeah, we've talked about the safe consumption bill, which would have allowed San Francisco, Oakland, LA to set up sites where people can go to use illegal drugs and be under medical supervision. And the arguments were that, you know, this could reduce overdose deaths by having medical personnel, you know, naloxone on hand to help people not overdose. But the governor said that he had some real concerns that this wouldn't actually do anything to combat addiction, a huge issue that's, you know, getting worse in this state. And yeah, I mean, a comment I heard is that if this passed, like the headlines would write themselves about, you know, how this would basically be state-sanctioned illegal drug use, and you know the governor would basically be signing off on that.
You know, another parallel I see when it is when it comes to labor rights. So there is a fast food worker wage bill. Look, unpack that for us.
Yeah. So this is a bill that would have, or he signed it. So he signed it on Labor Day, immediately after some national groups filed intent to seek a referendum on this. So It's a bit in flux now, but it sets up this fast food council. And the idea is that fast food workers can unionize right now, but, you know, it's hard in a store. When I've talked to fast food workers, they're working different shifts. There are very few of them on site at any given time. It's hard for them to, you know, organize. And so this would create a state-run council in the, you know, in one of the Department of Industrial Relations and bring workers, labor advocates, franchise owners, and the corporations, the big companies like McDonald's, to a table to decide on things like working conditions and a minimum wage. It would allow them to seek a higher minimum wage up to $22 an hour. So that was a huge concern for the franchise owners and for the companies that are worried about how it would affect their costs and their own bottom lines. Like I said, there's a referendum filed against it now, so they have a few weeks here to collect signatures. If they get enough signatures, around 600,000 by December, then it will go before the law will be suspended. It won't actually take effect, and voters will decide on it in 2024.
So still lots for you to follow, Nicole. And then on the flip side, again, I want to get into UFW. They embarked on a 335-mile pilgrimage. There are still people with UFW that are demonstrating at the state capitol. The governor hasn't officially vetoed it yet, but it's kind of been assumed, or he's indicated that he doesn't support the bill as it stands.
Yeah, he has said, you know, he vetoed this measure last year or earlier this year, and it was reintroduced, and he said that, you know, his concerns weren't addressed. This is an interesting one because President Biden weighed in on it earlier this week or last week and basically urging Newsom to sign it, which you don't see that often. but, you know, Newsom was asked about that in an interview this week and basically said, well, that's one guy's opinion, and my concerns weren't addressed. So I wouldn't be surprised if he does veto this. And we may see another version slightly tweaked next year.
Any other bills at the Capitol watchers like you are interested in?
There are some big housing bills to streamline housing construction on commercial land. That's, you know, housing's always a very tricky issue in the state capitol. But this would basically streamline permitting and reduce a lot of that sort of bureaucratic red tape, as housing advocates describe it, to build housing, you know, close to transit, in underused commercial spaces like these dilapidated strip malls. They'll build apartments on top of those. And yeah.
Yeah, you have a lot to sift through. There's still hundreds left to be signed or veto. You know, for months now, there's been speculation about Governor Newsom's future. We've talked about it on Inside as well. But when you look at the bills that he's vetoed, will veto, or has signed, which ones stand out as bills that really play into this narrative that he may be seeking a higher office?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about that safe consumption bill, a good example of this, where he, you know, basically kind of joined Republicans in his skepticism of this idea, vetoed that bill. On the flip side, I think the bill like Care Court is a good example for him facing this issue that everybody in the country knows about California's homelessness problem. If he runs for the presidency, he's facing very hard questions about this. And this is an example of him, an example where he can point to something concrete and say, look what we're doing. Look at this the difference this is making. Now, of course, a lot of questions, and there's going to be a lot of scrutiny on how this actually plays out and whether it actually helps people. And then I think, you know, there have been a lot of bills this year about gun control and bills to expand abortion access, kind of the same thing. These have been in a national debate over these issues for a long time. It's really ratcheted up this year. But signing these bills is a chance for him to argue to Californians and potentially people in other states that he is looking at these issues and he is trying to come up with solutions.
Yeah, I mean, he's had political ads running in other states, you know, Florida particularly. Exactly. In a few minutes, we're going to unpack the state's new abortion access website for services and resources. And this is for people who aren't only Californians, but also for people seeking an abortion out of the state. I guess what's the bigger picture here when it comes to a political strategy, if any, for Newsom by announcing the launch of this new website?
Well, this is interesting because there is a bill that requires a website like this, but he has not signed it yet. So for him to, you know, push this out before he actually signed that bill, you know, it came the same day that Senator Lindsey Graham announced that he would be introducing a federal abortion ban. It's a way for him, again, to differentiate California from red states that are cracking down on abortion, filling a gap that he sees sort of in loud vocal leadership at the national level on abortion and, you know, providing actual services to people that might need it. I think Newsom really sees himself or wants to continue to emerge as a national leader on issues like this. And, you know, as to the website itself, it has information about what your reproductive rights are in California. There's a tool to help you find an abortion provider. That bill that he has not signed yet includes, you know, would require to have links to resources like abortion funds. I expect him to sign that bill. That will be part of it eventually.
Nicole Nixon is Cap Radio's politics reporter. You're listening to Inside on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Governor Newsom is taking another reproductive step forward following the Supreme Court ruling overturning Roe versus Wade and leaving the choice to states. California has launched abortion.ca.gov, a website dedicated to those seeking abortion information and resources. The site is for both Californians and those out of state. Joining us to learn more is Amy Tong, Secretary of the Government Operations Agency, and Jody Hicks, President and CEO of Planned Parenthood Affiliates of California. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Amy, I want to start with you. You became Secretary of the Government Operations Agency in March of this year. What is your role in this?
I get to lead a team of technical staff from the Office of Data and Innovation and Department of Technology, and partnering with Planned Parenthood as well as public health to create this resource tool online.
You have a long tenure with the state. Your prior positions are Department of Technology Director, California Health and Human Services. You know, your bio states also that you've been really a champion of user-centered design, which doesn't reflexively have people think of state websites. So how did both roles, both technology and public health, benefit this launch?
Yeah, no, thank you for calling that out specifically. I think this is one other example that the state is really trying to transform to the way that, you know, we are here to deliver public service, and our audience and our users has to drive how they wanted to receive those information and resources. so that this site is specifically designed without participation of our users. And thank you to Planned Parenthood for hosting a stakeholder that has more than 40 entities participated to give us feedback on what are the information, what is the color of the website, what is the terminology that's used, the placement of information that would be best to help our users to utilize this.
For those who haven't actually been to the website yet, this just launched this week. Amy, how would you describe it?
We took a lot of thoughts into putting the website together where that the most relevant or probably highly seeking information is the location of the clinic. So that is readily available on the very top, and it gives you the choice of if you do know a particular city, not zip code, that you do want to go, you could search and narrow the results. But understanding there are folks that are coming out of the state that do not know where our cities are, it does provide a statewide view on the map, so they can have a choice of where they want to go as well. You know, examples like that is just a way of us, you know, making this site very, very opening and welcoming to anybody seeking the reproductive services.
Jody, as head of Planned Parenthood in California, as Amy just said, you really helped guide the state in making this user-friendly. What were the big, what were the main ingredients that you wanted for this website?
Sure. And, this was one of the biggest recommendations coming out of the Future of Abortion Council that was put together almost a year ago. And really trying to understand the impact of what the Dobbs decision would be. And now we're living in this post-Roe reality, but really looking at it from a very patient-centric point of view. And we've been talking with our colleagues in a state like Texas. We were learning from Texas at the time because it was the first state that banned abortion and what that experience was. And there's so many patients that have never traveled outside of the state that they live in. They're young people. They're navigating a public health system that's really hostile to their needs. And we have to reimagine how people get that care right now. So traditional tools are you punch in your zip code and you're really looking for providers that are where you're at right now. But for these folks, you have to look at where are providers in some other place, and we don't know where that place is. And so now here we are, we're in this reality where pretty soon more than half the country is going to not have access to care that 1 in 4 women of reproductive age need. And so this website is really designed that if you know that California is a place that will have safe and accessible abortion that's legal and available, how can you get that information? Or honestly, if your patients in California, there's so much misinformation and disinformation right now. People are just confused about what is legal. California patients are not excluded from that. I hear from them where people are saying, do I have to hurry and get an IUD? What is happening? They don't know the state of affairs because it's changing so rapidly and there's so much misinformation. So this is a website that lets you know what your legal rights are, lets you know where you can find care, resources that are available. And I really am just so proud of California for putting that work into it.
Do you have an idea of how many clinics roughly are available to people in California?
So we have over 100 Planned Parenthood clinics, and that's not including independent providers. They all vary in different types of abortion that they provide, some medication and some surgicals, but all of that. And again, that information is important to know wherever your call home and wherever you're seeking care. And that information will also be on the website.
Yeah, I would imagine, you know, over 100 clinics, you know, specifically with Planned Parenthood across 58 counties, you know, that you're hearing different needs depending on where they are located and who they serve. And did that go into shaping a user-friendly website? Because not only are there abortion steps, types of abortion, even how to pay, there's even information for individuals who are undocumented, under 18 years old, or even with language barriers.
Absolutely. And more to come as the website evolves. There'll be more information in different languages, more information as we continue to learn what patients are needing right now. You know, we're 2 months past Dobbs and we're still learning patient patterns and what that flow is going to look like. We're definitely seeing an uptick, for instance, in any city with an airport. You know, we know people like to drive, but that's dependent on how close that is. Or sometimes they just know someone in Los Angeles or in, you know, a city. And so they want to know what kind of care they can get there if they have a friend that they can stay with. So as we learn more, as more happens, we expect the website to evolve with that knowledge as well.
Amy, I want to get into this component of privacy and how the website doesn't track or save information.
Yeah, that is actually one thing very unique about this particular site. First of all, the entire resource kit online is developed by in-house resources. And with the understanding that there's, you know, extreme sensitivity that, you know, about, you know, privacy and all that, this site designed in a way that we do not track users. We do not use outside partners to run any of the analytics, and we do not collect IP addresses, you know, to see where people are coming from. And the state does not store that information anywhere or plan to share that information with anybody. So, you know, simply we don't have any of that, and really from the lens of protecting the user's privacy.
Hmm. When looking at the website, I go back to a conversation I had with Senate Pro Tem Toni Atkins at the beginning of the year on this topic. And she explained that it's also about making sure people have all the correct information available before becoming a state legislature. She shared a story about a person in the military seeking an abortion. They actually had an STD and thought it would automatically pass on to their child, which is not the case. Atkins, who worked in the clinic, explained that that's not true. The person went on to have a healthy child, STD-free. Does this website also provide that type of information as well, since, you know, you're not really confronted with this information until you're really in the thick of it?
Yeah, and I would say these are the feedback that there's a literally a feedback button on the bottom of the website. As more and more people using it, as more questions come up similar to this one, the website is going to continue to evolve with that type of content. And that's why I do want to emphasize this, you know, to Jody's point, that this is, to us, it's an initial launch. And there should be a lot more enhancement to it, but based on our users' feedback.
What kind of response have you had? I know it's only the initial days, Amy.
Very positive. And the fact that, you know, not only the information is out there, it's easy to use. And also that, you know, I know sometimes people hear about, oh, website, if there's a lot of user, is it slow? We took all of that into consideration. So people can easily access this over their mobile phone. And if there's a limited bandwidth or, you know, a Wi-Fi connection, this website would not be, you know, triggering any slowness or anything. So it's a lightweight resource tool for everyone out there.
I'm curious, Amy, since you worked during the pandemic, you know, and we still are in one, how did that shape how this website was created?
Thank you for bringing up the pandemic war. My goodness, we has a very similar approach to something called the COVID-19 that CA.gov that became the official website. Speaking of, you know, there are other sites that may have misinformation or people just have a lot of, you know, information that accessible to a lot of misinformation. We want to make sure everything is in a easy to access that CA.gov to and then has an official logo on it, number one. Number two, that the information is easily accessible regardless of the connectivity of the device that you use. And there's also phone numbers, I believe, that was listed under the contact. So in case there are folks that they just have a better way of connecting over the phone, those resources are being, you know, provided as well. So all in all, really coming from a user-centered aspect, what we think the information based on feedback that works for the way that people are expecting. And that's really the pandemic response approach that we took into this design thinking as well.
Jody, given that you said that, you know, places with an airport are seeing an uptick in need and services, and we've had this conversation on Insight about a bandwidth resource and just infrastructure issue, what kind of demand are you seeing for resources across the state since you have over 100 clinics?
I mean, they're definitely feeling the impact, especially our Southern California affiliates that are close to Arizona right now. But we've also done the work of investing in infrastructure to prepare for that. The health centers, you know, in addition with website, this website as another resource, health centers have also started hiring patient navigators. So their job, which is newer, their job is when they do get phone calls, they help with some of the logistics, like which airport to go fly into, how they can get from the airport to the health center, where there might be lodging needs. Even one of our health centers, I know, and I'm sure there's more of these stories, helped with childcare, for instance, for somebody that was coming from out of state. And so they've been preparing this entire year for what we knew was coming with this Dobbs decision, and really even prior to that, when we knew that there was threats with the last administration. So they've been doing that work, but definitely feeling the impact right now.
When looking at the map of clinics that are available, both Planned Parenthood and those outside of Planned Parenthood, you know, I expect to see clusters in metro areas like the Bay Area, Los Angeles, Sacramento, but there are stretches of the state without a clinic available. And we know that this will directly impact people in poverty, with socioeconomic disadvantages, people of color. What can be done in terms of having more accessibility for counties like Inyo, Mono, Kern, Imperial, or even up towards the Oregon border?
I mean, that's right. That was part of when we were looking at things from the Future of Abortion Council. It was both in California, right, that there's still deserts, there's still people within California that have to travel some 25 miles in order to get care. I mean, some of that is, and we've done a lot of work, and the state has as well, improving telehealth capabilities and even, you know, how our health centers can take advantage of that and really use telehealth as a good tool, including for things like medication abortion if you're in California. And so, and then also, again, infrastructure. I know they're looking at where health centers need to be placed. That's not something that can happen overnight, but it's certainly part of the planning of where we need actual clinics and where we need to improve with telehealth in order to reach patients as they need the care.
Finally, I want to get to a hypothetical that's being discussed as a possibility, depending on the makeup of Congress or even the next president. And that is if the legislative or executive branch or both ban the right to abortion. You just recently, like this week, Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican, proposed an abortion ban after 15 weeks after the first trimester, with exceptions for rape, incest, and the life of a pregnant person. What conversations are you having with other Planned Parenthood chapters across the country? What recourse could California have?
Well, you know, part of, again, what the legislature did is also put Proposition 1 on the ballot, which is ensuring that in our California Constitution, we have reproductive freedom, including abortion and contraception. It's not a foolproof protection against a federal ban, but it certainly is another tool that our attorney general would have to fight back against a federal ban within the state of California. And that was part of the reason for doing that, as well as ensuring that our own California legislature, no matter what it looks like, that people have protections. And I think it's also information. We're definitely seeing, right, that people, 70% of Americans did not want Roe v. Wade overturned, and they certainly want they wanted to have a protection that no longer exists, and they certainly do not want at the federal level to institute a ban and take away that protection even further than it already has been. And so I think, you know, us doing that work as well is really talking with voters and ensuring that really abortion is on the ballot. I think we've been saying that for a long time. I'm not sure people believed it. We're seeing across the country, they believe it now, and they're acting, and we're hearing those voices. And that's what we have to do as we are grappling with this impact that we had a federal protection, a civil right taken away. And I don't know when, if ever, that's ever happened for people in our country. And so we're really having to reinvent how we take that back right now.
Amy, in the last 20 seconds or so that we have, what conversations are you having with your colleagues at the state?
I mean, we're here specifically from my role, it's trying to make sure that, you know, once the decisions are made, they the information, what we can provide, we can make it out there as easily accessible as possible. And I would just have to say, you know, as a woman in California and a long-term public servant, I was just very proud to have this opportunity to create this resource kit. And just so that for the women that have a safe place to find helpful information.
Amy Tong is the Secretary of Government Operations Agency. Jody Hicks is the President and CEO of Planned Parenthood Affiliates of California. Thank you both for joining us. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Haley Reardon is a folk artist with over a decade of experience developing her sound. Hailing from Massachusetts, Haley has quickly jumped onto the scene with recognition from WBUR's Tiny Desk Contest and earning an artist residency in Germany. The music is deeply rooted in her life adventures as a world traveler and showcases influences from flamenco to traditional folk sounds. Currently touring the West Coast, Haley will be performing at the Sophia Theater in Sacramento tonight to showcase her latest music. And Haley joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
You know, your father encouraged you, really, your music development at such a young age. How did that help foster the artist and musician that you've become?
Yes. My dad was so supportive early on. I mean, I started writing songs when I was 11 and I wanted to sing them, and there was nowhere to do that without going to bars and stuff, and I couldn't drive. And my sweet dad, I would print out lists of open mic nights around New England, where I'm from, and he would say, which ones you want to go to? And he would drive me, and I kind of got hooked on it with some help. I needed a driver.
You have traveled all over the world. Have you been to Sacramento before?
I have never been to Sacramento. I've never been or performed here, so it's a first.
Hopefully you'll have a great time. The Sophia is a wonderful venue. You're no stranger, really, to NPR. You were featured on WBUR in Massachusetts, their Tiny Desk Contest. We have one here as well at CAP Radio. You made the top 25 entries in 2021. That must have felt amazing.
Yeah, for New Englanders. Yeah, it was a very nice, honor, and also just to feel part of the New England folk community, which is so alive and is what, you know, how I became who I am as an artist. It was an honor for sure.
What folk musicians and artists do you look up to that help shape the work that you do?
Oh, well, it's very rooted again in my New England upbringing. I love Anais Mitchell and a songwriter named Laurie McKenna. People I grew up going to see in folk clubs that my parents would take me to. You know, when I learned that concerts could happen in small, mm-hmm. intimate rooms and not in stadiums. So, yeah.
Well, we're going to listen to your clip, your Tiny Desk clip, and it's called After You.
I dream that you were blind and I went walking, looking for the light. But then I lost it, trying to bring the right thing home to you. I see now that nothing is a waste until it runs out. I built myself a castle just to climb down and rifle through the fragments of my youth. I've got a view.
You know, you talked about you performed in venues before you even knew how to drive. I would imagine performing in your childhood bedroom with a phone in your hand was a little different.
Yes. On my childhood desk. Yes. Full circle.
Yeah, full circle. And it was quite successful. You know, your talent and your career has led you to get a scholarship, a residency program in Germany. How did that shape your EP that is now out, In the Good Light?
Oh my goodness. I toured so much in Germany over the past few years and then was offered this residency, which was really a chance to like stay in one place and go deeper into the community there. But being me, I feel like a spider with like all these tentacles out in a million places. And that led me to Barcelona to work with an amazing producer and flamenco guitarist named Pau Figueres. To me, it's all part of this one chapter of like European adventures where I was living in Germany, but recording in Spain and touring all over. But it's enriched my creative journey in so many ways that I, you know, wouldn't have uncovered had I stayed in my safe little home. So it's been fun.
Yeah, well, that collaboration with Pau, you released a live session. And so we're going to take a listen to Awake in Berlin.
It's 2 a.m. I'm awake in Berlin for the first of two shifts. You are on your way into that restaurant on 12th that I never liked. There's a word for this feeling here, Einsamkeit. And while I'm asleep, you are driving back home to the place where we lived. Now you live there alone, where we'd hide from the landlord. Where girls upstairs, my guitar's in your closet. I know it's safe there. And I finally figured it out. For the first time, something's clear. There's no way of summing this up except to say that I don't know how I feel. And I'm not sure I ever will.
You know, you lived in Germany and you collaborated with a Catalonian artist in Spain. What was the experience like? How did it shape your work and your art working with people in different countries with different languages and musicians from different backgrounds, vastly different than yours?
Yeah. It was so inspiring. It kind of showed me that I can find home in so many places. And in some ways I felt the most connected I've ever felt to collaborators, even though there were all these barriers. Like I'd be working with Pau and our engineer Aniol, and they're speaking Catalan and I don't know what they're saying, and then I'm interjecting in English, but we almost had to rely more on other forms of like resonance, and it sort of deepened my experience of collaboration. And same thing for my time in Germany. My writing was so steeped in the sort of alienness, but also familiarity of being in a foreign place and having to kind of connect in different ways. Yeah. Everything felt deeper.
I love that you said that you can find home in many places. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that so many people can resonate with. Mm-hmm. You know, Spotify, which has become a powerhouse in showcasing new and upcoming talent, your music has been featured in really carefully curated folk playlists. I would imagine that is helped your career, but I'm also curious, how does it feel to be recognized in that way?
It's affirming. I mean, I've been like working on this thing, on my craft, on what I do since I was like 12, it feels like, writing my little songs and playing my little shows. So it's definitely affirming to have people say, oh, we like this, we want to put this in with songs that, in the playlist example, like put these songs beside songs that I admire and artists that I admire. So it's affirming, and the creative process still feels exactly the same. It's still, you know, always a mystery and an exploration, and then what happens, happens.
Well, what's happening is good.
Yes.
In 2017, you updated America the Beautiful, and you added lyrics to really reflect the current modern realities that we live in now. So let's take a quick listen to your version of America the Beautiful.
How beautiful for spacious sky. And amber waves of grain for country stores and dive bars where everybody knows your name. for the purple mountains' majesties above the fruited plain, for the woman reading to a child on a crowded city subway. For the Black Lives That Matter, more than they'll ever know. And for the grown man who's crying, where, oh, where did my life go? America is a beautiful America, the heartbreak America, the prideful.
Still yearning despite her mistakes. What inspired this modern update?
You know, when I was very young, I used to go to my grandfather's house every day after school. And for some reason, his activity for us was to learn and sing all of the American patriotic songs. And that's like my earliest memories of singing. So this song has always been kind of on my heart. And then in 2017, it was Trump times, and the song popped in my head one day, and that line, America, the beautiful, had such weight to it. It felt so poignant. And I picked up my guitar and it just sort of poured out, this idea of, you know, the beauty being in question, but still being inherently there and kind of weeding through the mess to get back to the beauty in the heart.
What response have you received in the years since?
A positive response. I mean, that song has connected with people, I think. And it's only felt more and more kind of resonant as time goes on, you know?
Haley Reardon is a folk artist performing at the Sophia Theater in Sacramento tonight and then moves on to Los Angeles in a few days. Thank you so much for joining us, Haley.
Thank you.
It's going to be a great time. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to join the conversation, you can email us, insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producers are Megan Minata, Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, and Helga Salinas. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineers are Antonio Munez and Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here on Monday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.